In the few minutes that she had been on the flight deck, she had already established a bizarre rapport with the captain. It was a blend of reluctant respect and overt hostility, and of sexual awareness. She had dressed deliberately to reveal her body, and in her excitement her nipples had hardened and darkened, pushing out through the thin cotton shirt with its suggestive legend. And the musky woman's smell of her body, again intensified by her excitement, filled the confined cockpit. Nobody spoke again for many minutes. Then the flight engineer broke the silence. 30 seconds to operations normal. All right, switch on the HF and make the report. Nairobi approach, this is Speedbird 070. Go ahead, Speedbird 070. Operations normal, said the engineer into his headset. Roger, 070. Report again in 40 minutes. 070. The blonde girl sighed with relief. All right, shut down the set. Then to the captain, disengage the flight director and make the turn to the new heading by hand. Let's see how gentle you can be. The turn was a beautiful exhibition of flying. 2 minutes to make a change of 76 degrees of heading, the needles of the turn and balance indicator never deviating a hair's breadth. And when it was completed, the girl smiled for the first time. It was a gorgeous sunny flash of very white teeth. Good, she said, smiling directly into the captain's face. What's your name? Cyril, he replied after a moment's hesitation. You can call me Ingrid, she invited. There was no set routine to the days in this new command of Peter Strides, except the obligatory hour on the range with pistol and automatic weapons. No member of Thor Command, not even the technicians, were spared daily range practice. The rest of Peter's day had been filled with unrelenting activity, beginning with a briefing on the new electronic communications equipment that had just been installed in his command aircraft. This had taken half the morning, and he had been only just in time to join his striker force in the main cabin of the Hercules transport for the day's exercise. Peter jumped with the first stick of 10 men. They jumped from 500 feet, the parachutes seeming to snap open only seconds before they hit the ground. However, the crosswind had been strong enough to spread them out a little, even from that height. The first landing had not been tight enough for Peter. They had taken 2 minutes 58 seconds from jump to penetration of the deserted administration block, standing forlornly in one of the military zones of Salisbury Plain. If they had been holding hostages in here, we'd have arrived just in time to start mopping up the blood, Peter told his men grimly. We'll do it again. This time, they'd cut 1 minute 50 seconds off their time, falling in a tightly steered pattern about the building, beating the time of Colin Noble's number 2 striker team by 10 seconds. To celebrate, Peter had scorned the military transports, and they had run the 5 miles to the airstrip, each man in full combat kit and carrying the enormous bundle of his used parachute silk. The Hercules was waiting to fly them back to base, but it was after dark before they landed and taxied into Thor Command security compound at the end of the main runway. For Peter, the temptation to leave the debriefing to Colin Noble had been strong indeed. His driver would have picked up Melissa Jane at East Croydon Station, and she would already be waiting alone in the new cottage, only half a mile from the base gates. He had not seen her for 6 weeks, not since he had taken command of Thor, for in all that time he had not allowed himself a single day's respite. He felt a tickle of guilt now, that he should be allowing himself this indulgence, and so he lingered a few minutes after the briefing to transfer command to Colin Noble. "Where are you going for the weekend?" Colin demanded. "She's taking me to a pop concert tomorrow night. The Living Dead, no less," Peter chuckled. "Seems like I haven't lived until I hear the dead." "Give MJ my love and a kiss," Colin told him. Peter placed high value on his newfound privacy. He had lived most of his adult life in officers' quarters and messes, constantly surrounded by other human beings. However, this command had given him the opportunity to escape. The cottage was only 4.5 minutes' drive from the compound, but it might have been an island. It had come furnished and at a rental that surprised him pleasantly. Behind a high hedge of dog rose, off a quiet lane and set in a sprawling, rather unkempt garden. It had become home in a few weeks. He had even been able to unpack his books at last. Books accumulated over 20 years and stored against such an opportunity. It was a comfort to have them piled around his desk in the small front room or stacked on the tables beside his bed, even though there had been little opportunity to read much of them yet. The new job was a tough one. Melissa Jane must have heard the crunch of gravel under the Rover's tyres, and she would certainly have been waiting for it. She came running out of the front door into the driveway, directly into the beam of the headlights. And Peter had forgotten how lovely she was. He felt his heart squeezed. When he stepped out of the car, she launched herself at him and clung with both arms around his chest. He held her for a long moment, neither of them able to speak. She was so slim and warm, her body seeming to throb with life and vitality. At last, he lifted her chin and studied her face. The huge violet eyes swam with happy tears, and she sniffed loudly. Already she had that old-fashioned English porcelain beauty. There would never be the acne and the agony of puberty for Melissa Jane. Peter kissed her solemnly on the forehead. "You'll catch your death," he scolded fondly. "Oh, Daddy, you're a real fusspot." She smiled through the tears, and on tiptoe she reached up to kiss him full on the mouth. They ate lasagna and cassata at an Italian restaurant in Croydon, and Melissa Jane did most of the talking. Peter watched and listened, revelling in her freshness and youth. It was hard to believe that she was not yet 14, for physically she was almost fully developed, the breasts under the white turtleneck sweater no longer merely buds. And she conducted herself like a woman 10 years older, only the occasional gleeful giggle betraying her, or the lapse as she used some ghastly piece of Rodine slang. Grotty was one of these. Back at the cottage, she made them Ovaltine, and they drank it beside the fire, planning every minute of the weekend ahead of them, and skirting carefully around the pitfalls, the unwritten taboos of their relationship, which centred mostly on mother. When it was time for bed, she came and sat in his lap, and traced the lines of his face with her fingertip. "Do you know who you remind me of?" "Tell me," he invited. "Gary Cooper. Only much younger, of course," she added hurriedly. "Of course," Peter chuckled. "But where did you ever hear of Gary Cooper? They had High Noon on the Sunday movie on telly last week." She kissed him again, and her lips tasted of sugar and Ovaltine, and her hair smelled sweet and clean. "How old are you anyway, Daddy?" "I'm 39. "That isn't really so terribly old," she comforted him, uncertainly. "Sometimes it's as old as the dinosaurs." And at that moment, the bleeper beside his empty cup began its strident, irritating electronic tone, and Peter felt the slide of dread in his stomach. "Not now," he thought. "Not on this day, when I've been so long without her." The bleeper was the size of a cigarette pack. The globe of its single eye glared redly, insistent as the audio signal. Reluctantly, Peter picked it up, and with his daughter still on his lap, he switched in the miniature two-way radio and depressed the send button. "Thor 1," he said. The reply was tinny and distorted, the set near the limit of its range. "General Stride, Atlas has ordered condition Alpha." Another false alarm, Peter thought bitterly. There had been a dozen Alphas in the last month, but why on this night? Alpha was the first stage of alert, with the teams embarked and ready for condition Bravo, which was the go. "Inform Atlas we're 7 minutes from Bravo." 4.5 of those would be needed for him to reach the compound, and suddenly the decision to rent the cottage was shown up as dangerous self-indulgence. In 4.5 minutes, innocent lives can be lost. "Darling," he hugged Melissa Jane swiftly, "I'm sorry." "That's all right." She was stiff and resentful. "There'll be another time soon, I promise." "You always promise," she whispered, but she saw he was no longer listening. He dislodged her and stood up, the heavy jawline clenched and thick dark brows almost meeting above the narrow, straight, aristocratic nose. "Lock the door when I'm gone, darling. I'll send the driver for you if it's Bravo. He will drive you back to Cambridge, and I'll let your mother know to expect you." He stepped out into the night, still shrugging into his duffel coat, and she listened to the whirl of the starter, the rush of tyres over gravel, and the dwindling note of the engine. The controller in Nairobi Tower allowed the British Airways flight from Seychelles to run 15 seconds past its reporting time. Then he called once, twice, and a third time without reply. He switched frequencies to the channels reserved for information, approach, tower, and finally emergency, on one at least of which 070 should have been maintaining listening watch. There was still no reply. Speedbird 070 was 45 seconds past operations normal before he removed the yellow slip from his approach rack and placed it in the emergency lost contact slot, and immediately search and rescue procedures were in force. Speedbird 070 was 2 minutes and 13 seconds past operations normal when the telex pull sheet landed on the British Airways desk at Heathrow Control, and 16 seconds later Atlas had been informed and had placed Thor Command on condition Alpha. The moon was 3 days short of full, its upper rim only slightly indented by the Earth's shadow. However, at this altitude, it seemed almost as big as the sun itself, and its golden light was certainly more beautiful. In the tropical summer night, great silver cloud ranges towered into the sky and mushroomed into majestic thunderheads, and the moonlight dressed them in splendour. The aircraft fled swiftly between the peaks of cloud. Like a monstrous black bat on back-swept wings, it bored into the west. Under the port side wing, a sudden dark chasm opened in the clouds, like the mouth of hell itself. And deep in its maw, there was the faint twinkle of far light, like a dying star. "That will be Madagascar," said the captain, his voice overloud in the quiet cockpit. "We're on track." And behind his shoulder, the girl stirred and carefully transferred the grenade into her other hand before she spoke for the first time in half an hour. "Some of our passengers might still be awake and notice that." She glanced at her wristwatch. "It's time to wake up the others and let them know the good news." She turned back to the flight engineer. "Please switch on all the cabin lights and seatbelt lights and let me have the microphone." Cyril Watkins, the captain, was reminded once again that this was a carefully planned operation. The girl was timing her announcement to the passengers when their resistance would be at its lowest possible ebb. At 2 o'clock in the morning, after having been awoken from the disturbed rest of intercontinental flight, their immediate reaction was likely to be glum resignation. "Cabin and seatbelt lights are on," the engineer told her, and handed her the microphone. "Good morning, ladies and gentlemen." Her voice was warm, clear, and bright. "I regret having to waken you at such an inconvenient hour. However, I have a very important announcement to make, and I want all of you to pay the most careful attention." She paused, and in the cavernous and crowded cabins, there was a general stir, and heads began to lift, hair tousled and eyes unfocused and blinking away the cobwebs of sleep. "You will notice that the seatbelt lights are on. Will you all check that the persons beside you are fully awake and that their seatbelts are fastened? Cabin staff, please make certain that this is done." She paused again. The belts would inhibit any sudden movement, any spontaneous action at the first shock. Ingrid noted the passage of 60 seconds on the sweep hand of her wristwatch before going on. "First, let me introduce myself. My name is Ingrid. I am a senior officer of the Action Commando for Human Rights." Captain Watkins curled his lips cynically at the pompous, self-righteous title, but kept silent, staring ahead into the starry, moonlit depths of space. "And this aircraft is under my command. Under no circumstances whatever will any of you leave your seats without the express permission of one of my officers. If this order is disobeyed, it will lead directly to the destruction of this aircraft and all aboard by high explosive."